Welcome to The Danger Room, a Marvel Crisis Protocol podcast focused on helping you prepare for the opponents you are yet to face. We discuss strategy, tips and tricks, and things you should know to level up your gameplay. Don't forget to join us in Discord and Patreon as we continuously discuss MCP on a daily basis. The links will be in the show notes. On the podcast, regular members are Jacob, Sploosh, and Dizzard. All right, welcome back to another week of the Danger Room and our first episode of all of us back together since, I don't know, about a month now. And we actually have a big announcement that we are going to be doing, and that is adding a member to the show, and that is Mike DeLuca. How are you doing, Mike?
I am fantastic and happy to be here and actually get credit for all of the opinions that I influence on this pod.
Wow, why not make an entry?
I'm just throwing some shade. No, I'm not salty about it at all.
I guess I think just explain is that one of the reasons we wanted to add another voice was there's been a couple of occasions where someone hasn't been able to make the pod for a week or a couple of weeks. And while we love having guests on, just having a third regular person so we can cycle in and out and maybe take some weeks off so that we can do some things on Sunday when we normally record. So just to give you a little peek behind the curtain there, you might get three of us on rather than all four of us at any particular podcast.
Let me explain Mike's little bit of shade there is that ever since and before NashCon, Mike and I have been more often testing together and just running ideas by each other. And then that allows me to plagiarize ideas that maybe Mike came up with. And, you know, I'd like to think that I give Mike some things too back, but yeah, so.
We definitely do. I really don't care about getting credit. Like, that's the truth. I'm not being sarcastic. It was more of a joke than anything else.
For sure. Yeah. I respect Mike a lot, though, and I'm glad he's here with us. And, yeah, excited to see what he can bring to the table. People can get sick of my opinion, so then you can hear Mike's opinion.
It's the same opinion. Yeah.
Spoiler alert, they are the same.
They're quite similar. And, so, you know, maybe, hold on, to explain, too, Mike and I were the guys crazy enough to play X-Men at NashCon. That's kind of was our thing. And, yeah, so it's I don't know. I don't know, Mike, if you want to get into your background at all. You've been on so many podcasts and mentioned for so many things. We've done the dark web together as well. That was fun.
Sure.
You got to be careful how you say that, Sploosh.
Well, in the context of MCP only, nothing illegal or shady.
Yeah, cool. I started playing the TTS League in Season 5, which was like the spring of 2021. I started playing MCP in the fall of 2020. So like basically around the time Drop-Off got banned. Been collecting the game since it came out. I just painted it up until I started playing. Decided that I just loved the game and just tried to get better. I spam LFG games back in those days to get better. And much to my surprise, I made the cut in my first season. So that was cool. Made the cut again in Season 6. And I got third at NashCon. And I got second at SoCal, losing to Sam. I always just lose to Sam Spam. So, but that was overpowered, and I'm glad we're past that.
And both of us are going to LVO.
Correct.
That should be cool.
With different lists this time.
Yeah. Are you sure?
Well, that's not 100% confirmed yet, but probably, yeah. We'll be running different stuff.
Okay, so quick question for you then, because I don't think I've ever actually asked you. Like, you said you started collecting the game from the very beginning. What got you into MCP?
Oh, I'm just a massive Marvel fan. I always have been my entire life. And then I also love tabletop, and I've always wanted a Marvel miniatures game, and just like the ones that existed just never scratched the itch for me. Like there was like the Night Models game and like HeroClix and such, and I just didn't really catch on. But I love this game. I love the mechanics, and it's my dream game essentially. So I spend a lot of time playing it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, as Jacob said, we're planning on typically our episodes will have three of us on. Occasionally, we might do all four if it's a big topic or something that we just all really want to talk about. But the goal is we'll be cycling the three of us in and out, and you will hear differences from week to week. When Mike and Sploosh are on at the same time, it'll probably just be repeating voices. but
aside from that, we welcome Mike to the show, and we all hope you enjoy what he adds to the show. And moving on, we want to talk about the fun, I don't know, last month we've had between putting together the Christmas special and watching your guys' reactions to it. I know I'm grateful for all the opinions that people have had and the praise that people enjoyed from those episodes. I know Jacob has a lot more to say than that, though.
Yeah, I think firstly, I want to say a big thank you to all of our contributors who took the time to record those episodes and give their experience and opinions. So there's, you know, 14 people who aren't in this podcast who then made some really high quality content. What I really love is going into some of the Discord channels and seeing those episodes being linked by people who have nothing to do with the show going, give this a listen. This is a really good introduction to how to play this faction. Oh, that always makes me smile, and it always gets a heart react from me when I see that.
Awesome. So we're going to go ahead and move on to our Xavier Protocols segment. And Jacob, what do you have for us this week?
So this was a request from one of our patrons, A Goose. I believe there's an excellent game featuring them. It's lacking a title, though, so maybe he wants to work on that. In our Discord, we have a patron-only channel, so if you become a patron for the show, then yeah, you can get access to us, and we'll take suggestions. We often put shout-outs for topics or questions people have or suggestions for Xavier Protocol sections, and this is exactly one of those. So A Goose has been playing a lot of Miss Marvel and kind of not understanding all the hate she appears to be getting online because it seems to be doing some serious work. In particular, the high five attack. And for those of you who might not be as familiar with Miss Marvel as A Goose clearly is, then this is when she's embiggened. So you have to pay 3 power to get her embiggened, and then it's a 5 dice range 3 physical attack. But if she's an inhuman, so she's got a reroll 1 on it, and then she's got if she's bigger than them, so if they're size 3 or less, then she gets to reroll an additional 2 dice on it. So it's a 5 reroll 2 reroll 1 attack, which kind of, you know, the mental maths of it is you're thinking, well, that's kind of like 8 dice. And what A Goose wanted was us to dig into the numbers of this a bit and sort of see. He's been finding that this was a really powerful thing that was happening, that was doing really well for him in the games he's been playing with her. So I had a look at the numbers, and rerolls are a pain. Rerolls are a real pain for the way I work out the numbers, because I do it all in a spreadsheet rather than using code, and I suspect this would have taken me a lot less time in code. But anyway, we got there in the end. And sometimes it's comparable to an 8 dice attack, sometimes it's comparable to a 7 dice attack. So for getting 1 or 2 successes or more, it's basically an 8 dice attack, so it's as reliable. But the numbers aren't very different to a 7 dice attack, so it's not very excitingly different to a 7 dice attack at those low values. For getting 3 or 4 successes, well, let me give you a good indication here. 4 or more successes is 64%. So roughly 2/3 of the time, you're going to be landing 4 or more hits on that 5 dice attack. And that seems, you know, pretty good considering you're only picking up 5 dice when you first roll. Getting 4 of them to be successes is, yeah, that seems really good. And that's kind of where it sits. That sits in between a 7 and an 8. By comparison, 7 dice would get you 60 and 8 dice would get you 71% chance of getting 4 or more. So it's kind of somewhere between a 7 and an 8 dice attack. And then after that, the spike potential sort of drops off a bit. I mean, it's still better than a 6 dice, but it's not as good as a 7 dice. So to give you a rough rule of thumb, I'd call it sort of a 7.5 dice attack. That feels about right. But that maybe explains what A Goose is seeing. And got me to think a bit more about the character. And I think there's a couple of issues around her throw, because her throw is the same cost as her embiggen and is only when she's not big, and you can't get back to being small until the end of the activation. So you kind of have this choice. If you've got 3 power, do you want a control piece who can throw something, or do you want to punch stuff? And the really annoying thing is her embiggened attack generates power for damage dealt. So you'd like to then go, I punch you with this cool attack, generate some power, quite likely to get 3 power, seems pretty likely. And then I can use that 3 power to throw, only she doesn't have the throw and she doesn't have a way to get back to the throw. So that, I think, is maybe where some players are finding it just doesn't quite click together as a kit. But I think really where she's going to shine is if you can get off two of those attacks when Inbigen. So rather than having to move Inbigen attack, remember Inbigen will be a transformation, so you get a range one place onto a massive base as well, a 65 mil base. If she can just spend three power and then get 2 7.5 dice attacks essentially, then that feels like real value town. I mean, if you think a lot of characters have a 7 dice attack for 3 power as their spender, and it doesn't generate power, whereas this one does. So I think it's about managing your expectations about what you're going to get out of her. If you can position her correctly, sit her on 3 power and then make 2 really big attacks, well, she's going to be, you know, like a mini juggernaut in terms of damage output, maybe. I mean, bit less, because you're probably not going to get the auto damage as well, but still, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Awesome. Yeah, I've actually been debating on putting her into X-Force just to double down on those rerolls and her aggressiveness.
Everybody who's playing the Danger Room drinking game, take a drink. Dizzard mentioned X-Force.
I'm gonna stop doing that. I keep forgetting that.
No, you're not. Don't lie.
You're right.
Yeah, right.
I'm obsessed.
5 minutes later,
take a shot X-Force. Every time Dizzard says X Force is good or viable.
Oh my goodness, they're viable. What can I say? Anyway,
sorry, Dizzard. Tell us about the novel and X Force.
I don't know, because like you think about it, like because I'm currently writing that series of articles based on just focusing on X Force, and like with what I'm saying, it's okay. I get it. It's straight up like one of the big key themes that you're looking for. Your out of affiliation characters is who can abuse rerolls. So you got Zemo, you got a Medusa was always good. Doctor Strange versus Supreme is amazing. So why not double down on rerolls with Ms. Marvel? So it's just a thought.
I just noticed, looking at Ms. Marvel, she doesn't actually have a spender attack. So no. In a way, that throw maybe is supposed to be used, maybe not like the turn she's supposed to gain power, but like the turn after that she gets all the power. And that's her intended purpose. She's definitely like kind of a turret in the end of the day, but she's an interesting character for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she's great in Web Warriors, if that's not obvious. being able to reroll skulls, because rerolls do have a little bit of diminishing returns. I've definitely learned that playing Zemo and MODOK a lot. So, yeah, being able to reroll skulls is a good time.
Yeah, I've been messed up by Ms. Marvel a few times. And, getting the skull rerolls. And I think her team-up card with Miles is actually not that bad.
What's that even called?
Better Tomorrow.
Man.
It has something to do with like she embiggens and then like Miles places off of her or something like that. And you get a lot of distance on it.
Yeah, they each pay 2 power and then she gets big and then he jumps off her or whatever.
Right. And that is also, I believe, 1 cheaper than her normal embiggen. So I think embiggen costs 3. So.
Yeah, Miles helps her pay though, but yeah.
So you could do this on round 2 without interacting with Ms. Marvel, like move her up the table, top of round 2. This card goes off. You and Biggin bust some face. Could be good.
Yeah, also in Biggin normally it's just a transform, which is range 1, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
The card is a range 3 in Biggin.
Ooh.
That's true. And she's got the large base, and I believe she gains extended interact range in Biggin.
Yeah.
Form. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
All right, then. So we're going to go ahead and move on to our hot takes. And we're going to talk about something that came out over the holidays. And that is 23. I think she was officially spoiled last week or the week before, something like that. I guess I'll go ahead and start because I can't say the name of the team anymore. X-Men. She's great in X-Men. to be honest, X-23 is by far my new favorite edition of the year. Honestly, probably my new favorite edition of the game for the past at least 8 months, to be completely honest. Like, I love her more than Gambit.
Moon Knight? Remember when you were obsessed with Moon Knight?
She makes me
remember
about
Moon Knight? Oh, no,
I forgot about him. He's got a new show coming out that I'm actually kind of interested to watch. But
it's a trailer on Monday, which is today.
But I think 23 is actually really awesome. She's extremely mobile. And she does very consistent damage. And of course, dice will be dice and you'll whiff sometimes. But for the most part, having that Pierce on Builder and Spender, she is extremely consistent. And then throwing a certain affiliation's reroll back on top of it, then it just helps out. I love X23. By far, she's gone in every single one of my certain affiliations lists. And as well as X-Men, I think she's great there as well. I think Splooshes had played her more in X-Men than I have, but I think she's just a solid character and a great addition to both of these teams. What do you think, Jacob?
Yeah, she punches stuff real good and it stays punched.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Mike?
Yeah, when I first read her card, I was like, she doesn't have charge. Like, her action economy is like kind of iffy. But after seeing her played, I think that was like, I think I was undervaluing her big sis superpower.
Yeah.
But when you pair her with X23, her mobility gets pretty sneaky because like your opponent's going to attack Honey Badger and then X23 suddenly gets a charge. So yeah, deceptively mobile. She punches about as hard as you would expect. And after she gets like the Claw Rush train going, it can be quite good. And she kind of opens up like a healing factor tribal.
Yeah. Would you say she's pretty sneaky sis?
Clever.
So apparently it's a new year and Jacob's coming out with the puns more than ever. what do you got, Sploosh? What do you think of X23?
So I thought she's better than Wolverine when I first saw her, but that's like not saying much. And then I actually played her for like 3 games and I was actually, I'll correct that. I played against her a few games with you playing her, Dizzard,
yeah.
And she was overperforming and I was like, okay, I actually have to take this character seriously. So then I played her a few games and she blew my mind. Like, so first of all, like she has this midline gameplay where she can do a move and then like a claw rush off of no matter the cost. And by the way, like you staple no matter the cost to X23, which a lot of people said that for Wolverine, but she actually just uses it better because she only takes 2 damage and then heals for 2. So it basically is free. And then she's got that amazing 6 dice plus pierce and a free movement after, which is basically her action economy. And she gets the reroll when she attacks. So it's like a 7 dice attack, as we kind of talked about earlier with Ms. Marvel. I mean, it's similar in my mind to 7 dice, but also gives the free move and has pierce, which is just crazy.
Yeah, which, I mean, the maths of that is kind of add a dice, so it's kind of an 8 dice attack, sort of.
And if she kills someone, you might have played first class, so she could pick up the thing for free. Or she still has a power because she used no matter the cost, so it was free anyway. And sure, maybe you don't kill them, but she's already now in a great position with like basically almost like a triple move that turn and an attack. I mean, that alone to me is crazy. I think as a bit of a Dormammu fan, I think she fits into Dormammu great because she just needs 2 power per turn and she can just claw rush like a maniac. So that's cool. I don't know what else to say. I don't feel forced to bring like the exceptional healing card with her. I think at 3 threat she's just kind of value. I could see with like X-Force maybe you bring it because they have so many healing factor characters that are actually good, like Deadpool or something. You know, so that's a thing. But when I played X-23 and X-Men, to me she felt like a perfect like friend of Domino's. Because it's like Domino's like one of the best killers in the game. But then X-Men didn't really have like another affiliated like super killer. And now you just have X-23. So you have your, you know, Storm, X-23, Domino. It's like that's your core.
Yeah.
And sure, like you can play around with other things. But I think this makes X-Men more aggressive. And that's kind of how I like playing them anyway. And yeah, I don't want to get into it too much. But I've been very impressed with X-23. She's super quality.
Something I'll add, you mentioned not taking exceptional healing all the time, but it's almost not necessarily needed because she has a defensive reroll as well. And she's only 3-3-2, but the defensive reroll does help, and the healing factor 2 definitely helps. Like if you think it's annoying to take out Deadpool, like she's just as annoying. But also, it's like, and this isn't me exaggerating or forgetting games or selective memory, whatever you guys want to call it.
You guys.
I'd say I'd probably have a good 30 games with her since she was leaked. And she's gone down, like, KO'd maybe less than five, like, easily less than five. And that's fluffing the number a little bit on the Moore side. Like, I'd say probably two, if I recall correctly. She hardly ever goes down, and I don't know why. The opponent tries to take her down, but for some reason, she just loves to live. And exceptional healing definitely helps with that, but she's definitely going to be a nuisance in the game and a great damage dealer. I love X23.
Yeah, I think she obviously works well with Honey Badger, which we'll talk about probably next week. But
yeah,
they go well together. But I definitely don't think she needs Honey Badger at all to be a good character. And like I said, in some situations, I can even see her like with Dormammu or something played unaffiliated, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, very cool character. Happy to have her. It's just a little depressing because like we've had like 2 years of Wolverine, and that, well, I know Wolverine's only been around a year now, right? Like, cause yeah. he came out last year. And then it's like, everybody was joking that she would just be the better Wolverine. And then when we saw her, she kind of is the better Wolverine. It's just like, ugh, okay, whatever.
That's true to the comics.
Yeah. Is it true? I haven't read too much with her, but there's actually a really cool moment, a couple cool moments with her and Gambit in the comics. Gambit kind of becomes like a father figure to her for a while, and it's kind of neat. So, it works for me to have her in the game.
Absolutely. All right. So next we're going to move on to a quick little New Year's goals or resolutions, whatever you want to say. We did it last year. We kind of recapped on that at the end of the year episode. So real quick, we're going to go over what our hobby goals are. Since we have a lot to talk about, we're going to try and keep it to like one each of us. I know Sploosh has a big one for the show, so I'll leave that to him. But my personal resolution for this game is this year I would very much likely to be completely caught up on painting on all my models because I fell very much behind during the deployment. So I would like to be caught up on painting as well as attend more in real life big events. Like I'd like to go to Adepticon. So those are my hopes. What about you, Jacob? What you got?
I really like, we're going to limit it to one, except me. I'm going to give you two.
It was quick. It was like 30 seconds.
Yeah, and last year we did the same thing, and then we all just agreed to do everybody's because remember, we agreed to play more, and then we all
did that. Then we just did everything. Cool. It was like an hour-long episode because we just kept talking.
Yeah.
All right, Jacob, what do you got?
I think what I want to do is I want to play more casual games at my local game store. Now, COVID's been a big thing, obviously, but we've got the local scene is beginning to grow. And as much as I enjoy the competitive and the grind and the practice towards honing a roster really well, I also want to build a local community, which is a bit more diverse. So I'm quite happy to sort of have a really hyper competitive online scene, but then have something where, you know, I'll take some defenders because why not? Because, you know, they've got cool characters and there's not a lot of reason to play them apart from that. And throw down with some people. And, you know, I've played a couple of fun things like the Hulk Ultimate Encounter and the Separation Anxiety event, and they've been great fun. So I want to do more of that.
Awesome.
Mike?
Oh, man. So my local scene's actually growing, and it's very exciting. People are starting to get excited about like weekly games at the shop. I think we finally found a shop that is convenient for everyone. So that's really great. I want to see that continue to grow. But my personal goal, I feel like at this point, is just to win something. I've had multiple high placings at every event that I've been at, and bringing home a W would be nice. So,
all right. And for me, I gotta think about how I should say this. So, in my opinion, we're a podcast that loves this game. I mean, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't love the game. And I feel like we show that love by thinking about the game, talking about the game, and expressing our feelings on competitive MCP is kind of the core of why this podcast exists. And also I think from the day one, before this, we even made an episode, we really wanted to like feel like we're kind of like helping people like think on their own and sort of like come up with cool ideas and sort of understand how we get to our ideas. But, you know, I feel like sometimes for whatever reason, people read into things we say as sort of being negative, and for me, I want to try to be more of a positive sounding person, even though I feel like I've always been positive. You know, I can understand that maybe I give the impression that I'm a negative attitude towards stuff. And that's, my resolution would be to try to be like more positive and in my outlook to things, and maybe not give up on stuff so quickly that maybe, I don't know, give it another thought or whatever. So, you know, people can read into that however they want and interpret it however they want. But yeah, that's definitely something that's been on my mind, and I also want to see if I can improve on it.
So Swoosh, I got a question for you real quick.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on Gene?
Next subject, please.
I had to. I'm sorry.
I think X-Men actually has decent game into Black Order because of Gene.
Yeah.
And Domino, for that matter. So she's sometimes troll. Actually, mostly troll, but sometimes she's not.
I just got to say, I've been really having fun with Cassandra Nova lately. And I don't know. Maybe someday I'll get into that more in future discussions. But I'm like starting to turn and look again at that character. I always felt like she had some potential, but I was had concerns. But yeah, Jean's cool and all, but like Nova's where my heart is right now.
Yeah. So awesome. I'm just going to also repeat Spooch's talk about just his want to be more positive. I think all of us have kind of a goal for the podcast as a whole to not, I guess, have the reputation of being negative, because I've seen it quite a few times actually where on the Facebooks where people will say, oh, the Danger Room is incredibly opinionated and can be extremely negative, when that's not what we're trying to do. We're just trying to basically say our mindset of how things compare in a competitive focus, and that does come off as negative at times. So I think that's another way of saying what Spoosh is saying. But for the podcast, we're trying to be a little bit more positive this year, but remaining honest, because there's no point of this fluffing characters or certain things, because then it's like, what's the point of the podcast at that point? So remaining competitively focused, but adding some positivity to the things that aren't so great.
Yeah, well said. Yeah.
All right, so we're gonna go on to the main topic of today's episode, and this is something that Sploosh has been wanting to talk about for, I don't know, since it came out, and kind of get into it. We waited on it forever because crises were changing and how things were done were changing, and it still happens to be a pillar of the game. So this will be a pillar of the game main topic, talking about Research Station. So Sploosh, why don't you go ahead and tell us why Research Station is a pillar of the game?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'll just say, to remind people, pillar of the game is just like a thing in the game that you have to like be at least aware of and have a plan for. And, you know, if you're going to play competitively, and I'm going to go to LVO and I have to keep Research Station in mind, and there's Season 7 coming up for the online TTS League. Research Station is just kind of always in the back of my mind, and who's good at it and how can I be good at it or good enough to not lose on it. And I mean, you know, I think at this point, Research Station has been around for how long? Like, who even brought this to the game? I can't
believe
even
it was Scarlet Witch's box, which came out in May of last year. So
yeah, man. So we're coming up to like a year at this point. It's crazy. And you know, I remember certain voices were saying that Research Station should be banned and stuff. And I thought at the time, that's kind of silly. I'm not saying I think it should be banned now either, but it is it's kind of an egregious, very like warping extract. So if a team is good at it, you need to be kind of worried and know. And I'll just state the obvious that like Criminal Syndicate loves Research Station. In the old meta, it was also insane for Sam Spam. Maybe, I don't know, you guys, I just want to throw out there, who's like insane on Research Station? Like, who's the best of the best? Is it more than what I mentioned?
Black Order likes it a lot too, because Sam can just control it.
In 16 Threat is easier for Black Order now than it's ever been, right? So, yeah, I think Black Order's pretty clean on it. Mike, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Black Order likes it. Obviously, they struggle now with, like, if Corvus dies, their game plan kind of folds, in my experience. And fighting in the center of the table is very dicey. Like, Corvus doesn't have the output he used to with like very rare flurry triggers and know all you've got. So if you don't, if you're not reliably like killing models quickly and your opponent is able to punch you back and kill Corvus because everyone's just dogpiled in the middle, it can be very risky for you as a Black Order player.
Fair. Yeah. It, anytime, you know, this or Gamma, you're forcing dice to be rolled and you never know what will happen, right? Sometimes you just roll like three shields with Corvus and you want to die inside. What about Wakanda? Does like Shuri have a shot on this by just, you know, shooting people off of it? She's definitely more restricted nowadays with the no size four when Hulk might be more popular than ever.
So I could speak to this because I actually played piloted Wakanda with Research Station to the cut in season five. I liked Research Station. I think Black Panther is very good on it. And Okoye was very good because they both just want to stand in the middle and like count blanks for defense and such. Mm. But like sometimes Shuri, like you need, sometimes you need all of your bodies to stand on the research base to score it. And Shuri really does not want to stand on the research base. Especially since you want to keep moving it into the evac, it becomes farther away from Shuri. So she needs to take move actions.
That's true.
So you get less value out of her pushing people away. And then it gets even worse if your opponent starts backstopping characters because everyone's dogpiled in the center.
Mm. Well, kind of flip that round, is maybe Web Warriors better because a lot of their displacement is towards, so you're taking them away from where you want the researcher to go?
Oftentimes I find that your front line is going to be blocking the good push lines. So like if I'm playing like Black Panther and Gwen, Black Panther's like in the way of the direction that I would want to push the opponent into me.
Yep, I can see
it
can
be tricky
because you're so densely crowded around it,
right?
I mean, I think anyone who's got a decent amount of beams is going to be worth mentioning. So I mean, that plays into the Avengers you mentioned, that they can bring a bunch of beamers, but there's plenty of other places where beams are good. I mean, even in like Red Skull Cabal with a whole bunch of beams, and that's going to generate a bunch of power.
I do really think Avengers likes this crisis. Round one Avengers Assemble is an incredibly strong play. I would argue too strong, but it is what it is. And Vision can just walk Avengers Assemble, beam like two, three people, throw size throw three, which off. Is everybody in criminals, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he can pretty much do that in both leaderships with Steve and Sam. Because like with Steve, he's getting a cheaper throw. And they're all Avenger assembling anyway. So yeah, it's crazy. I agree with that. So maybe is it just mostly Avengers and Syndicate and then kind of like the others are pretty good. And then I guess everybody else is like whatever.
I mean, I think any sort of attrition team, so something like Midnight Suns maybe, or Convocation potentially. Anyone who wants a big punch up in the middle and that's their game plan and that's what they want to do. Brotherhood is another one.
How about this, Jacob? There's this team called Defenders. are they capable of playing this still?
They're nowhere near as good as they were, clearly, when you jump everyone through a portal and sit on there and make a bunch of attacks. It's one of the better ones because you clump everyone up for Strange to hand out buffs, but at the same time, then they've got a concentration of people attacking Strange. And if to steal a line from Pat Dunford, there's a strange correlation between Strange living and Defenders winning.
Fair enough, yeah. So do you? They've lost their luster, but they, like you could still kind of portal turn two and make something of that, maybe. Less exciting.
Less exciting. Big power sink for a turn when you want to be spending that power, probably doing other stuff. And then if you're spending your power portaling, you're not spending your power to make the portal and then jump through the portal. You're not spending that power bumping defenses, so you're going to take more damage. I don't know. I'd have to play it, but I don't feel any great pull to play it.
I mean, you're going to run all your characters to the middle, and where do you go from there? With a new portal.
I guess it gets around the symmetry problem with the portal. A round two portal is a lot less good than a round one portal because your opponent gets to use it to go somewhere interesting. But if the interesting place is the end of the portal where the researcher is, then probably you're going to get better use out of it than they are. But still, I don't know. It feels like you're not going to be contesting it round one, and so they're going to be pushing it towards you, so you're getting less use out of the portal anyway. Yeah. I'm not convinced. Let's put it that way.
Let's segue into like another thing that can make you just lose to Research Station, which is just playing Research Station wrong. I'll just say from my finding playing Research Station is that if you like really Research Station kind of dominates most secures in this game, with the exception of like maybe Gamma, except Gamma kind of like is playing the same map design anyway. So yeah. It's kind of a wash.
Do you want to just explain what you mean by dominate? I think I know what you mean.
Well, what I mean is like, let's just say hypothetically you're playing like Infinity or something as a secure. The correct play is probably to basically focus your entire team on Research Station. Even though it's just 2 points for like the first two turns, if you get to move it on by the, you know, so the second turn you win it, you move it basically on the opponent's side of the board. Now you're getting, you know, 4 VPs every turn. And generally that's just going to overshadow a secure. Not to mention, especially when it's not flip secure. So when it's just like a regular secure, you're committing characters and threat values to sitting on obscured points away from the Research Station so that your characters are not really like contributing, and you're going to just lose like momentum throughout by the time you get to like turn 3, the game's kind of over really. If you're only committing say 30, I don't know, 50%, let's say, or 60% of your team to the Research Station, then you're going to eventually lose those characters, or you're going to get worn down, and then the opponent's going to completely control it. And then on like a map D, I mean, now they're just taking over your home point as well. So now they're like also just controlling secures while also dominating extracts. Basically, the point is like Research Station is this massive momentum shift that cannot be ignored. You know, similar, I think, to kind of how Gamma could theoretically even ignore extracts to some level, because Gamma is just such a high scoring, secure, and Gamma was part of our original first pillar of the game. In such a way, Research is also just as dominant. And I don't know if you guys want to add to that or your experiences, but that's how I found it plays out. Is when Research gets thrown down, you almost just ignore the secures at that point. Not completely. You might still have like a home character, someone hopefully that's ranged that can like contribute to the Research Station. And I do want to get into like moving the Research Station, because I think that's a whole nother tactical conversation. But do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I mean, my experience very much jives with yours. There are very few cases where the right play isn't to go heavy into the researcher.
Yeah, I've had games where I have learned to just commit my entire team to the Research Station, and I'll see my opponent, who's maybe a little more inexperienced, put like even just one model on like a side D secure. And I already know, like, I've just won the game pretty much. And it's an unfortunate truth of the way the crisis is designed, but it's the reality we live in.
Yeah, which is why I was kind of saying, when we're saying like what's good on Research Station, playing it correctly is good on Research Station and can make you lose if you play it incorrectly. So just bringing it or playing against it or whatnot, knowing that fact is a big one, you know, one up on the opponent or whatnot. So I'll say now too that mostly it's correct to always move the objective towards the opponent's base. It's probably easier to talk about when it's not correct than it is to talk about when it is correct. Mike, you and I actually did some like commentating during the season 6 cut. And I remember one game in particular where the player did not do that. And I feel like it cost them the game, even though the game was like sliding out of control for the player and it looked like they had no shot of winning. To me, had they just moved the researcher twice towards their opponent's side of the board, I think they had a shot to win. And it just seems to me like it's, even if you're just moving it towards their base and then you're conceding that you're now like kind of losing, just by like falling back, you are not going to lose, because it'll take your opponent like 4 turns just to get it to your side of the board, which usually means the game's over at that point, because it's, you know, if you've moved it twice and they move it four times, it's like the end of the game. So there's only six turns usually in a game. So I don't know. Again, I don't know if you guys disagree with me on that. I mean, I could see the argument for sure, like sometimes to not do that. But I think it's very rare, personally.
So I guess moving it towards your side of the table is often a mistake because it lessens the amount of time your opponent needs to score the evac value, the evac points, in case, on the off chance that they do just secure it over you, which can happen due to dice or whatever. The goal should be to just push it forward into their side of the table and just put it in such a way that it's not on any of their characters are not contesting it after you move it, so that they still have to take a move action to get on it anyway. And if you can put it on your characters that are farther ahead already, then that's even more value.
Yeah. Setting that up with your bigger base characters on the far side of the researcher, if possible, really helps.
You also don't have to go straight at their point. You actually can do kind of like a 45 degree angle, which is effective in that maybe like the opponent's characters are more like leaning, say, on the left side. So instead of like kind of going straight towards their side, which would be closer to their character, you can kind of do like a 45 degree angle off the center and then go as far away at 45 degrees as possible. And that kind of helps also to you to catch up to the thing that you just moved. And then the next turn, doing the same like 45 degree angle, you'll be on the home point anyway. So do you see what I'm saying? You're lessening the distance you have to travel while also potentially getting a little bit of advantage by moving away from whatever side the opponent's on.
Mm. This might be a good point to talk about the medium movement ruler trick.
I was just going to bring that up.
Come across that. So when you move the researcher, you place it within two. The researcher token is 1 inch wide. And you, if it's within one of the home research lab base thing, whatever it's called, then that's another 1 inch. So it's 5 inches, the range to place the 1 inch token and then to be within 1 inch. And the medium move stick is nearly exactly 5 inches. So if you put down your medium move stick and the researcher ends up touching that, so medium move stick on the base where you're trying to get the researcher to, and the researcher ends up touching the medium move stick, then you know you're within one placement of that scoring, the extra points guaranteed. Equally, you can use this on one of those rare occasions you do want to move back, which maybe we'll get to. You can check that you're placing it outside of that medium move range to make sure that if your opponent does spike and contest it, you don't accidentally let them put it back onto your home base for them to score those extra two VPs.
So I don't know if people got that, but basically, and Jacob, you can correct me if I'm saying it wrong, but I think one thing you could do is like put the medium movement tool on like the home point, you know, using the grooves, and then measure it straight towards the researcher station thing. And it has to be like slightly within the grooves. It's not perfect. Like the actual point-to-point of the medium tool is actually a little too long. So, and we learned this from playing Hired Muscle, right? Like, this is where I learned it. Hired Muscle taught me this trick. But, yeah, so then as long as the researcher station is within the groove of the medium tool, then you know that the range to place will get you the score. So, and then so Jacob's saying basically, like, if you want to, like, sort of retreat, but not give your opponent a one turn extra score, you can just use that medium tool, put the researcher outside of the tool, and then you know that even if you lose the next turn that research station, they won't be able to score it no matter what that next turn, the extra two VPs. So yeah, that's just one thing I want to make it super clear though that I learned is do not think that medium tool tip to tip is enough. That's actually a little bit too long. So you want to make sure to be in the groove of the thing. And if you don't believe us, just like go and do this on your own table and you'll see really quickly that it works. I'm not big on all the measurement tricks, but that's like the one trick that I will never forget because of Hired Muscle and I use all the time. You can use that even when you kill a character. If you're not sure when you kill a character, if you're going to be able to get it, just use the medium tool and you'll know. because it's the same measurement. It's range two place, range one from the token, and then your character interacts. So it's a very helpful tip. Can you want to talk about though when I think actually, Mike, you kind of were mentioning this. So almost never a good idea to go backwards, but it's kind of okay maybe to go sideways. Like, so maybe you don't want to commit to going towards your opponent, and you don't want to go obviously towards your base, so you just kind of go left or right completely. I'm willing to concede that maybe that's like kind of a good idea, but like, what's an example like when you wouldn't want to go towards their base?
I actually just struggle to think of a situation where that's good. I mean, moving it forward puts like, it's such a high win more because it puts a clock on your opponent. And especially if you're moving it to a spot where they're not already contesting it, so they have to move anyway. Like, what's the difference if they have to move towards you or towards their own deployment if everyone's in the middle already?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I didn't think about this prior, but also I think if you do the math, if you score their side just one time, I think mathematically you can lock a game out just by doing that, right?
Pretty much, like, yes.
You basically get four plus an auto two. Yes,
right?
Yeah, well, it depends on the secures, but that's... So if you win it twice, that's four VPs. And then now you've won twice and you've moved it forward. So now you're getting guaranteed two VPs, no matter what, because that's just how it works. Like, once you manage to get the thing onto their home point, 100%, you will get two free VPs just by having it on their home point, and there's nothing they can do about it. So that's six VPs if you win twice with the research. So then you just need to score more on the secures, and then your opponent, if you know the game will end on, say, turn four, then your opponent max can only get four VPs if you just like run away from the researcher. And then at that point, you only need five VPs from secures and the game ends. And then you just don't get tabled either is something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, In my experience.
What I'm trying to say, the corollary of that is if you win it round one and round two, maybe you don't need to fight over it anymore.
Yeah, basically.
And then go and do the secure game, and they're having to commit people to go and get the researcher to move it off so you don't get even more VPs for free. But they're not going to get it back to the point where they're scoring, where they're going to outpace you on the extract tracks, if you like to like separate the VP tracks into secure and extract. You're going to be ahead on extract track, and you can then afford to have gone a little bit behind on secures, because then they're going to have to be committing resources to the extract to keep moving it, while you can go around and do secure stuff.
Or how about this? You also no longer need to win on the researcher. You only need to tie. Because if you tie on it,
that's true.
That's let's just say you tie on turn three. That's still two VPs for you. And then another two PV the next turn, guaranteed. And then even like, let's say you lose it on turn three. So now it's moved off their home point. You still can just tie it even like the next turn or two, and that's enough to like keep that like VP advantage you gained. And you, like you said, you can use less resources on the researcher and just focus on the secures and just kind of like time the game out, basically. And that's why I was saying earlier, and kind of like I think Mike was sort of saying, not sending it towards the opponent's side, it's just generally a mistake, because I've seen games where literally if someone just doesn't get tabled, they'll win because of all the early advantage they got off of the research station. Go ahead.
I had a game against Hellcannon last season where it was a researcher, and I think the secure was like Riots, like Extremists or Cosmic Invasion or something, some D secure. And I went really hard to score the researcher the first two rounds, and even though my She-Hulk took like 15 damage on round two from like a Miss Marvel activation. So I was like very much dying attrition wise. And I only won because Enchantress was able to just secure the researcher, and I had such a high lead that I could just run to the corner of the board, and he just doesn't have enough game time to score points.
Right. Yeah. No, I remember that game, and I exactly. And so if you're not aggressively positioning the researcher, you're allowing your opponent like a sort of a catch-up mechanic, because now they're starting to kill your characters. Maybe they got some lucky dice spikes, and it's close enough where they might still have enough turns to get some extra boost in VP, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like a race against time, basically. And the more you push that thing away from your base, the safer you are and the more time you have to play with.
I think kind of speaks to why Criminal Syndicate is so good on it, because yes, they're so advantaged at scoring it in those first two rounds. And then maybe after those two rounds, you're taking away their advantage because you're dazing the characters. But it doesn't matter. Just those first two rounds is often enough.
Yeah. I think something that's a little bit of a mind game with researchers, especially people who haven't played it that much, which I would implore people to actually make sure you play this quite a few times to understand all of it, is you'll catch some people off guard to where, like, when you do say, okay, I've got enough research points, I'm going to back off now, to where your opponent actually thinks that they can win at that point when it's already too late. Like, it's like a false sense of hope. Because I've actually seen that quite a few times where a person's like, oh, you're just good up on research, I'm just going to take this and I'll win. It's like, no, you're actually, the game's pretty much over at this point. You need to focus on something else other than the researcher. I think it's kind of interesting because, like, typically by round three, like you guys have been saying, like, if you were able to score researcher round one and round two, then you almost certainly are going to be the one winning the game, which is kind of interesting because it's one of the few scenarios that's like that, which I think is why we consider it a pillar of the game. So I think something of interest to talk about next would be, like, what are you bringing to combat that?
That's a good point.
I have one.
Throwing characters and having more activations than your opponent. I mean, a researcher was completely dominated by Enchantress in season six. And a lot of what made Sam Spam gross on researcher was that they had more characters than the opponent.
And almost every character has a push.
Yeah, well, but just being able to always have Enchantress go last was a really big deal. Having Avengers Assemble and Sam's leadership and the fact that Enchantress beams and the fact that all you got was in the game. There's a lot of reasons that they were dominant on research, but a big one was just going last. And even though researcher is an extract, it plays like a secure, and to win secures, you tend to want to activate last.
Yes.
I don't know, man. Things to bring to win on researcher, characters that are durable, like things like Heroes for Hire.
My number one thing that I would say, and I've pretty much done this with every single list, is Lizard and Monkey Brain. Like, I will put that in pretty much every single list just because of researcher. It's almost guaranteed you will win researcher the round that you play that. It's almost guaranteed. I wouldn't say it's 100% guaranteed, but it's fairly certain you will be winning researcher that round.
Just in case Lizard people aren't familiar with, Monkey Brain is Lizard Home as a card, because it hasn't been that popular. You want to talk through what it does and why that plays into this situation?
Well, basically, it's an area two attack. It's only five dice. Lizard pays three power for it, which typically round two, you should be able to play it because you'll have two power from the turns and you can easily get one power off of an attack unless you're just super unlucky with dice.
Or getting attacked, obviously.
Yeah, or getting attacked, which if you throw a lizard up there, he's probably going to get attacked and survive. So he should have three power by the end of round two, when this is probably the best time to play it, because let your opponent get research in round one, or if you can get it, just get it, and then save Monkey Brain for later. But Monkey Brain is area two attack. Basically, everybody gets hit five dice. The damage doesn't even matter, and you get to push everybody short no matter what size they are.
Yeah, I think this card is like very much slept on. It has a lot of play on crises like Research Station and Gamma Wave. And I think just now that the Tactics card slots are more open, it's more viable.
Yep. And that's why pretty much ever since the change to 10 Tactics per slot, I literally throw Lizard and Monkey Brain in pretty much every single list because of how impactful and how important researcher and even gamma, like, because the same plan works for gamma. You can literally run lizard to your opponent's home point, pop this, and you're scoring 3 points. Like, it's actually pretty good for those types of secures. That's one thing that I like to look at is lizard, or basically anybody that has a size 3+ push or throw.
Well, I think to be a little bit more restrictive than that, I think anyone who can move two people off in one activation relatively reliably. So a great example, obviously, is Thanos with his cosmic portal. As long as he's got four power, he can portal two people off. Or if he's got the mind gem, then he can. It doesn't even need the. It doesn't even need the extra power. He just needs two power, which he'll get from having a mind gem. So
yeah, it's true.
Typically, it can be difficult to go late. I mean, you normally want to go late with Thanos because he's an amazing control piece. But you often, if you're running Thanos, you're probably not getting the last activation. Maybe you are, because you've beaten up a whole load of people. But he goes in quite a lot of lists quite nicely, I think, and he's a nice, easy splash with the changes to gems. So having a Thanos is an option. Things like you need to build the power, but there's no limit on webline apart from you can't target the character more than once. So if you can get a core Spider-Man or a Gwen with a bunch of power on them, then you can move multiple people off. That's quite good. So just look at your affiliated characters, look at the characters you're bringing. Who have you got that can move more than one person in a round? Medusa's another one to think about.
Magneto, if you maybe.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Medusa's even better because she can move your characters onto the researcher while moving your opponent's characters off with Royal Decree.
Yeah, Medusa's still great.
It's
she is limited size three, but yeah. And dice. She doesn't flurry quite like she did before.
No, and you've got to get the damage through, so you know sometimes the dice just say no.
No, her push is a wild trigger now. There's no damage required.
There we go. That's the way. They changed it, yeah. So, but still, you got to hit that wild. So sometimes, you know, let's talk to Dizzard about rolling wild. So I think that's probably another drink, is it?
I didn't say it. You did.
Yeah, well, I playing Dormammu. There's a lot of characters, but when I played Dormammu and I didn't get wilds, it always like annoyed the crap out of me because it's like his only way of gaining power. And so it definitely made me aware of like when you can get real cold on wild rolls. You know, it's just like, man, seriously, come on, give me a wild, please. The other one I just say is like maybe like a Mothership Magneto right on top of people. He's pretty, I guess it is awkward. No, because he can't do the move people thing if he's at range two.
Yeah,
so it's kind of awkward.
Well, you can choose where you asteroid M him into.
Yeah, you could set it up, but you kind of want like him to kind of go some sort of last, and then if he's not like getting on the point himself, it's a little awkward. But
You know, Doctor Strange can kind of do it as well. But again, he needs to deal one damage, but with the reroll, you've got some pretty good odds. So
yeah,
any of those characters who've got the ability to move more than one character and then just have them go as late as you possibly can and hope you've loaded enough guys on for whoever they've got to go last to not have enough power or luck to deal with.
Yeah, on paper, Midnight Suns are weird with this because Voodoo is a very, very good character. And also Voodoo has Possession, which can't sleep on that. But between Voodoo and Strange, I mean, Midnight Suns, that's two key, super great characters. It's just they're kind of expensive. So that's kind of a thing because you're not really going last unless you're killing stuff. And then kind of gets into something else I want to mention. So in the old meta of Season 6 and the old rules of the game, one of the big things about Research Station is that you could force 16 threat. And 16 threat is, in my opinion, the lowest sort of like kind of fair threat value.
Good.
Because, yeah, I find that 14 and 15 threat, in my opinion, competitively, are not the most fair threat value set. You know, when certain people are bringing five cost leaders, it's just tough to like play, say, like 14 threat. I think 16 threat is still kind of a stretch, but it's at least like getting into the range or the realm of like squeezing someone, but not too much. But anyway, with the new rules, if you play Research Station, you might not be able to choose the threat value. So, you know, where before you could put 16 threat research and have like the best 16 threat research team ever, now you need to be more flexible, and your opponent might not be so bad at like, say, 19 threat Research Station, you know? So that changes things a little. And I do want to mention, sort of like a tangent, we did a Pillars of the Game on Sword Base in the old system, and Sword Base was the same thing. I think Sword Base at like 17 threat or whatever isn't that bad. But when you were forcing 14 threat, that's what kind of squeezed people really hard. And it's the same thing, you know. Now you can't, you almost cannot force a 14 threat sword ever anymore, based on the way the game works. Because if you have prio, then you can see that they have sword and then just take secures, right? And if you don't have prio, your opponent shouldn't give you the option to do sword, you know? So in theory, 14 threat sword should be impossible unless the opponent's playing like senators. And so that makes, in my opinion, sword more fair in the game right now. And researcher isn't so dramatic, but I think it's still relevant to bring up in that the new rules have kind of changed researcher a little bit, and that you don't feel squeezed at the 16 threat quite as often maybe as you were in the past.
Well, 16 threat is also the new sweet spot for Black Order, who are probably running a double gem Thanos, and therefore that 16 for double gem Thanos, Proxima, and Corvus with the gem.
Yeah, so true. And I don't know, that's just, you got to be careful with 16 threats in your rosters, in my opinion. Like, if you feel like you're scared of Black Order, probably having 16 threat objectives is maybe not the greatest thing to do. Because,
well, and we said, yeah, Black Order don't hate Research Station either.
Yeah, and we're kind of tangenting here, but I think that Black Order's strongest point value in the entire game is 16 threat. I think any threat higher is weakens them, and I think 15 or 14 is just kind of weird. I don't think Black Order can really get stuck on 14 unless they get really unlucky, but 15 they can handle with just adding a 2-drop to their roster. I don't know much about 14 because I don't think it's very likely that Black Order would get stuck on 14, and I think they probably have another affiliation to play at that point anyway, so they just wouldn't bother playing Black Order at 14. But yeah, I don't know. It's just something to think about. Like, if you're worried about Black Order, probably bringing 16 threat might not be like the greatest decision. But any other thoughts, guys? I don't have much more to say on research other than just be worried about it if you need to be.
I have one thing.
Yeah, Mike, you go.
I know a lot of people are excited to play researcher because it's not a odd numbered extract in the new rules, so they can't get screwed over if they get no priority put on extracts. And I think you might be a little upset when you find out that some affiliations just squash you on it like criminals. So I would implore you to maybe double think yourself about playing research base, even though it is not stealable by Angela and Space Loki and ASM and whatever. But you could be screwed even worse.
You know, Mike, that actually reminds me too, another thing, if you want to beat research, and this is kind of a theme I'm just finding in MCP period, flip secures actually help a little bit with research because you can flip stuff and then kind of get back to focusing on research. And if you're one of those rosters that has a lot of characters, like a spam kind of list, like maybe, I don't know, Guardians or Avengers, you could just like dedicate one, like two threat to just running around, just flipping things, you know, and just kind of like forward the secures. I don't know that's like the counter or anything, but it's definitely like kind of annoying for a team that's focusing on research if somebody's just getting tons of VPs without even focusing bodies. Do you agree with that? Or
yeah, if you have like a Sam Wilson who can run around on like spider portals and cap everything while throwing shields, and then you have all your frontline characters standing the researcher, it's brutal.
Yeah. So flip secures, I they're really polarizing right now in the game, I think, but just one more reason to bring them might be like it's a soft counter to research a little bit.
Yeah.
You know.
So I had a bit of a thought, and I think there's a parallel here with Gamma. So I'm going to pose a question and then kind of try and unpack why I'm asking it. Do you think it's a good idea in a competitive roster to bring Research Station? Now, even let's assume even the ones we think are really good, like Avengers and Criminal Syndicate, it can just happen that because of dice, you just lose. You know, you've got, even though you think you're advantaged, you've got all the tools and you've got all the tech, sometimes a couple of good attacks happen, or they generate just enough power to trigger those abilities. And I've seen plenty of games where something strange happens in round one or round two, and suddenly they're behind the cue ball, and they're just stuck, and they've kind of lost the game because some dice have said that. Now, when you're a competitive player looking for kind of consistency, that kind of puts me off wanting to bring it in a roster. And I feel the kind of the same way about Gamma, that again, you know, you're one spike away from the game completely swinging round. We don't need to talk to Sploosh about spikes swinging games on Gamma in finals, do we?
No, please. Yeah. No.
Memories.
You just brought back some bad memories right now. Thanks, buddy.
Well, yeah. That's kind of intentional in order to kind of contextualize the point. Do you feel that in a competitive roster, these kind of all-in, big VP crises are a good idea?
I mean, in my opinion, dice are going to always be dice anyway. Like, and as competitive players, we like to pretend that, like, we're above the dice, or like we've found ways to dodge dice or manipulate dice. I mean, I bring, like, you know, Zemo with Master Swordsman and Genius and God knows, maybe even Dark Reign. And I'm thinking, oh man, here's the time. This is going to be big damage. And then I just roll like three skulls. And you just are like, no. Yeah, even worse, Doom Prophecy, Master Swordsman, Genius. And you're like, yeah, baby, here it comes. This is the big attack. And then just a horrible whiff. You do like one hit. I've done it. You know,
absolutely. But my point is, when that happens, and as a result, you lose, you don't get a VP, and your opponent gets one because now they've got that secure or whatever. That's how about two this, VPs.
Jacob? I'm with
recoverable.
You.
You can come back from that. Whereas if you do that on a gamma point, it's a four VP swing on whichever gamma point you're on, because you either lose one and they gain three, or lose two and they gain two, or lose three and they gain one, whatever it is. It's a four VP swing for these things when they happen. And it's, I don't know, even higher on researcher potentially, it's like a six VP swing. If you thought you were scoring two, but instead they score two and then a bonus two. So I just
feel like... How about this, Jacob? You ever heard, like, under a long enough timeline, we'll all be dead, right?
Right.
So what if, my argument is, the faster you make the game, the less likely the bad dice roll thing will happen to you.
I can see where you're coming from. But then when the bad dice roll thing does happen, then the game ends straight away. Whereas on, I don't know, just a standard four secures, or like three extracts or four extracts, kind of standard, what you think of sort of normal MCP crisis, the bad thing is, okay, I'm gonna have to work a bit harder, and I'm gonna have to maybe get one of my own dice spikes to get back in this, but I'm still in the game. You know, I'm down a touchdown, but I'm not, you know, they haven't completely won the game straight up because that happened. And that can cut both ways, I guess.
I mean, you're just, it's, I don't know, man. I mean, the game is kind of dicey, right? Like, I've just kind of given in to, like, this idea that I have any control. Like, I have some control, and like, I hear what you're saying, but I'd like to think that if I'm bringing research, I've also brought characters that excel at it and maybe can pull me out of a bad situation. Like, maybe, for example, like a Black Panther can double push two characters, and he's made up like a profit, and maybe that two pushes only ties the secure because I had such a bad turn. But you know what? Like, I'll take it, right? Like, if my list is designed around research, then I should be better prepared for it. Like, maybe I'm the guy with the monkey brain or card or whatever, monkey brain, lizard home or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that's just where I'm at with it. And I totally understand where some people are a little more skittish of that. And maybe I'm wrong, you know? I mean, that's just a choice every person listening has to make for themselves, right?
I'm interested.
I don't know that there's going to be a right answer. Personally.
I'm interested to get Mike's take on it.
So I try to avoid the dice at all costs. I love, me personally, I know this is a contested opinion, and a lot of people think this is a negative play experience, but I really enjoy playing uninteractive games of running around and scoring points. So I was only playing Researcher when I was playing A-Force because both Hulks are very good on Research Station. And like I had Enchantress at the time and Medusa, and it was almost trivially easy to score the Researcher twice. So it didn't make sense to not bring it. But these days, I wouldn't bring it unless I was like just the best on it, period.
And that being said, I had the great experience of turn two killing your She-Hulk in a game.
She-Hulk has bad games more often than you would like as an A-Force player. And she holds them back, in my opinion, but that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah. So you're less, well, you're kind of just saying you're, most competitive players don't want to rely on dice. They want to feel like they made a decision that won them the game, not the dice won them the game, you know? And I get that.
That decision could be not bringing Research Station.
Well, I think if I was playing like Double Hulks and Avengers, I would play Research Station 100%.
Yeah.
What's your take on it?
So for me, I think it comes back to what we used to say about Gamma, and that is the people that like it are going to bring it, so why give them what they want? Why am I going to bring Researcher when my opponent sees that and they want the chance of playing Researcher? They will just give me extracts and hopefully I draw Researcher, when those types of people are going to just be like, okay, well, let's say I'm playing Syndicate. Syndicate is more likely to be playing Scoundrels and they see that I have Researcher. So now they have a chance of getting Scoundrels and Researcher, which is, in my opinion, a terrible thing if you're not the Syndicate player. So that's just kind of my thoughts of it. I think it's, if you have a plan for it and you know that your plan works and it's tested and you are completely prepared to play Researcher, then sure, play it, because you know that you have put the time in and reps with it. If you haven't put that much effort into it, then I really don't think you play it. Unless it's like your last option. Like every other extract is terrible for you. Like my current list, I'm putting Researcher in it because I think I have a solid Researcher. I've played it quite a few times and it's worked. It's not ideal and I dislike it and I wish I put something else in there, but it's better than any of my other options. So that's why I'm going with it.
I would like to add that for me personally right now, all the extracts in the game feel like pick the three that are the lesser of all evils.
Yeah.
All the extracts feel bad in some way. There's always going to be some situation where your extract sucks for you, no matter what you take. And I think this is a reality everyone has to live in at the moment.
It's fair.
So.
Yeah, I never thought of it like that, but you're right. I mean, like, yeah, I don't care what you pick. You know, you might not have prio, and then that's good for them. Or in this case, you do have prio, and then, well, I guess you wouldn't have to pick secures or extracts if you didn't want to, but I don't know, things are just a little bit more random and a little bit more out of your control, and the threat values are a little bit more out, you know, unpredictable, and like you kind of always could be in a bad position with the extracts for sure. And even like scrolls and those things, like people say, oh, those are kind of neutral, but then like your opponent rolls it on turn one and you're just like rolling your eyes because they're on the opposite side of the board. It's just like, oh no, what have I done? It's a lot of like the lesser of the evils, right?
Yeah, extracts don't feel in a great spot right now.
And maybe what you're getting at, Mike, too, right, is that Researcher, if you get the wrong opponent, Researcher in your list might just be like, real, like, you're like, again, I hate to keep picking on Syndicate because like Syndicate is just so easy to talk about just because they're so focused on what they do. But if your opponent is playing Syndicate and then they get the secure they want and they get Researcher, I mean, that's just a nightmare.
That's probably just a loss for almost every list.
Yeah,
and the game hasn't even been played yet, so
right. So what you're getting at kind of is like, you want the lesser of the evils and you want to not just have like a bad day when your own extracts are against you. So you definitely don't want to take Researcher if you're not like completely prepared for it and capable of beating those teams.
You know? Yeah. The way I've looked at extracts now is like, what happens if I'm playing this extract? Like I have three extracts. If this one that I have chosen gets randomly selected, what is like the worst situation I could devise and what is my answer to that? So if you can like comfortably be like, okay, I have a plan. If everything goes wrong, then you know you found something that's probably worth playing. And sometimes there isn't three of them and you just have to YOLO it.
There is one thing about Researcher that makes it kind of unique. It's immune to like possession. Well, not completely possession, is it? But like Enchantress Steel and Black Cat Steel isn't really relevant on Researcher.
I mean, and Spider-Man and Angelo. And Space Loki.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the Venom Blast or whatever it's called. And
no, yeah, like ASM.
I mean,
actually. Oh, yeah, the middle grab stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another point I wanted to make earlier and completely forgot about until you just mentioned this now. It's the only extract where you can score points without spending power. So those teams who have poor power economy in the early rounds, this is great for them.
Oh, that's a fair point. I think Web Warriors have to be at least acceptable on this. I don't think they're the best of the best, but they are the team that doesn't want to spend power, and this doesn't cost power. It's true.
And yeah, Web Warriors have a very weak front line. You're usually going unaffiliated for your frontline characters, and if Gwen and Miles don't have anywhere to stand to generate value in the early game, it can be rough.
Yeah, definitely see the concerns for it. I'm sure, though, that there are... It just comes back to, like... And this is the thing with just the way the objectives are played right now, is that it's very polarizing, you know? Because you're either, like, the best it secures, or, like, the best it extracts, or want the game to go as slow as possible, and you're the best at that. And then there's a whole lot of teams in the middle. And it's hard to talk about those teams in the middle, really, because... Like, oh, well, they might be, like, better, but they might not, you know? And it's so much easier to talk about the extremes because you know for sure they like it. And that's just kind of where the game's at right now.
Well, that wasn't a very positive conclusion despite our resolutions.
Yeah, what? Yeah, it is what it is. I don't know what to say.
You failed.
I'll do better next time.
Well, you can always just not play Researcher.
I mean, you could.
Yeah, just don't do it.
Yeah. It's a fun one, though.
Your positivities is it? You get a gold star.
Yeah.
Actually, how about this? Try to end on a positive note, but I've built a lot of rosters that are not like the Black Order or whatever, okay? And I don't think I've added Researcher to any of them. Would you guys agree that that's just the correct choice? Like, basically, okay, X-Men, Brotherhood, Cabal, you know, I don't know what else I've been building. But, yeah, you know, I don't think I've added Researcher to any of those rosters.
Again, I've only added it to mine just because it's better than the other options.
No, you're also a madman.
That's fair. I accept this.
Is my dorm list to have Research? I don't think I'd put it in dorm either.
Wait, let me look real quick. I'm not quite clear. Which affiliation is that you're talking about?
The one that can't be talked about.
almost got you.
No, yeah. No. My Dormammu Web Warrior roster doesn't have Research. Yeah, I gotta say, I always knew this because I'm the one building my rosters, but I don't put Research in basically anything that's not like the Black Order or Syndicate or whatever.
I'm playing it in Wakanda A-Force. I think it's quite good there.
You got Wakanda, so.
Well, She-Hulk also really likes.
Yeah.
And like 16th right, you can play She-Hulk, Angela Scarlet, which is really great on Researcher.
Well, so for mine, I'll just say, I know we're getting really long time, but for my 16, I've been really enjoying Storm, Badger, 23, Strange, and Lizard. Sorcerer Supreme, Strange.
My Convocation roster I have Research in, but they got a lot of shenanigans going on.
Yeah, plus Strange can teleport anybody completely off of it.
Yeah, they have the Astral Ring stuff, and they're just really good at fighting and kind of brawling. Yeah.
Isn't that 15?
Mine?
Yeah.
No.
Storm 23, Honey Badger, that's 7. No, that's 8. Maths is hard.
You're the math
guy, Jacob. Oh, no.
Exposed. It's late
here. Give me a break.
He's a little rusty. We haven't done one of these in like a month. So.
But, I think that wraps it up though for research.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So something we want to just give a quick announcement for is if you head over to the main TTS server for Discord, I'll put a link in the description. Season 7 is upon us, and basically roster locks and submissions will be due by the 12th of February. So Season 7 for the TTS League is coming up. This is a great opportunity to get games in if you enjoy playing on TTS or if you're new to it, because it's just a great way to get games in. Typically, last season we had 220 people, something like that.
I think it was 230, personally. But
anyway, above 200. It's by far the largest MCP event, even if it is virtual. And it's always a good time. People enjoy them. I enjoy them. I enjoy helping out with them. And it's just a good old time. So if you're looking for some games to play on TTS, that league is coming up soon. Also, something I forgot to mention earlier when Jacob was talking about the Patreon Discord. Somebody joined our Discord the other day and said, I had no idea your guys' Discord was free. So just so you know, our main Discord is actually like free. Like anybody can join it. There is a link in the description for the podcast. So you can join that. There's just one channel within the server that is Patreon only. So yeah, just so you guys know.
Secrets are being revealed.
So yeah, come join the Discord, because it's always a good chat in here. There's always something going on.
It's an event. Like my favorite part of the day these days was like seeing what's going on in our Discord. It's getting to be like the social hub of MCP.
Yeah, if you think X-Men are bad, or if Black Order is a negative play experience, you will fit right in.
Hey, man, we even have Pagani like trolling around in the background, which makes it fun.
Yep.
Don't like tag him or anything, but he's always watching, which is hilarious.
He's always now we're completely off topic, but I think it's hilarious when there's a reveal day where something comes on, and if you like at Pagani with something, he will immediately respond. It's hilarious. Like it's like he's sitting there watching for all the salt to come out.
he you can tell his favorite part of the day is when they reveal something, because I think he likes to see the reactions, which makes sense. If I spent a lot of hard work designing and developing and producing something, I would be really curious to see if people like it, right? I'll never forget when Omega Red came out. He said Omega Red was like his favorite mutant or something, and he was really into like what people thought of Omega Red. So
yeah. Anyways, I think that's gonna wrap us up before we keep going on tangents. So new year, new Danger Room. I think that's pretty explanatory.
Are we welcome season Mike, two, by the way? You need to maybe name this.
Let's go ahead. Yeah, welcome to season two, everybody. There you go. professional it. As ever. Everybody,
all the announcements at the end of the podcast.
Yeah. Everybody, be sure to go and play your favorite X-Force team. Bye.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our opinions. Please note, as time continues, some information may become outdated, but we will do our best to refresh some of the more prevalent episodes to be current. Be sure to check out Across the Bifrost Nexus, where you can find all of your MCP content. And a big thank you to Discount Games Inc. and Blackgate Games, where you can find all of your MCP needs. And then a huge thank you to Atomic Mass Games for developing a game we all enjoy and love. We'll see you next time in the Danger Room.